It's Tibet Week at Emory University, an annual week-long celebration of the Emory-Tibet Partnership. The festivities include lectures, guided meditations, and a mandala demonstration. That's an intricate sand painting created by monks over the course of the week and then wiped away. And for this year's Tibet Week, the Carlos Museum presents the Alice S. Kandel Shrine, a collection of 124 icons and objects from Tibet. Alice S. Kandel is an avid collector of Tibetan Buddhism iconography, and we'll hear from her later in the show. But first, Gabby Watts visited the shrine at the Carlos Museum, and there she spoke with Emory Religion Professor Sarah McClintock about the role of the private shrine in Tibetan Buddhism.
Now, the function of a shrine is really as a focus for one's practice as a Buddhist. Many things happen at a shrine. Prostrations, recitation of prayers, offerings are probably the most important thing. A shrine is a place where one can make offerings to the Buddhas, but also it is a place where one can focus one's mind and think about the qualities that one would like to inculcate in oneself. The icons on the shrine represent various enlightened qualities, and the practitioner comes before the shrine with the idea that he or she would like to emulate these same qualities in himself or herself.
Could you talk about some of the objects that are here in this shrine? What are we seeing?
The way the shrine has been set up here in the Carlos Museum is meant to emulate the shrine in a home. So there are wooden cabinets that would be typical in a wealthy aristocratic home, and these are covered with beautiful carvings and paintings. And upon the cabinets are placed the icons. As you'll notice, they are in several rows, and on the very top row of the highest cabinet, you will see three Buddha figures who represent the Buddhas of the past, present, and future. Just below the highest level of Buddhas, you have on the left-hand side a figure named Padmasambhava. He's what's known as a tantrika, meaning that he is a practitioner of the tantric form of Buddhism. And he has a little bit of a mustache, and his face is in a slightly fierce demeanor. Padmasambhava is famous for having subdued and tamed the local deities in Tibet. The story goes that when Buddhism was first brought to Tibet, the local deities were not that happy about it because they were anxious that their own offerings and so on would be interrupted. But Padmasambhava was able to teach them about the Dharma, and they became converts and now are considered to be some of the greatest protectors of Buddhism in Tibet. On the other side, on the second layer down, you see a lovely Tara. And Tara is a Buddha who has, in a previous life, because I think you may know that in Buddhism, it's understood that people are born again and again until they become Buddhas themselves. In a previous life, Tara made a vow that she would seek to become enlightened in a female form to help beings who can relate better to a female Buddha. She is there. Tara is known for her ability to save people. Crown inlaid with turquoise. It's made of gold filigree. There are lotuses coming behind her, and she is decorated with the jewelry of a celestial Buddha.
There's also, it seems, an interactive element with the shrine, or there are bells, there's sounds, there's rice, there's that it's poured into the bowls or is in the bowl. So could you talk about the interactive elements with the shrine and what sort of sounds that you might hear?
Again, it really depends on the practice that the person is doing. But almost every shrine will have offering bowls. The bowls can be filled with water or they can be filled with rice. The idea is that when you come before the shrine, you request the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas of the three times and the 10 directions. In other words, all the enlightened beings in all the worlds, you request them to come before you. And then you make offerings of the kind that you would make to somebody who was visiting your home. And sound is one of the offerings, nice music or sound. So Tibetans will generally have a bell on their shrine, and they may ring the bell at the beginning of their practice session and at the end. Now, there are other kinds of practice that include even more instruments and sound, and you do see some evidence of this on the shrine. For example, on the left-hand side here, you see two conch shells, which have also been inlaid with silver. And the conch shell is a symbol of the Dharma. It's played, in fact, and it makes quite a loud noise. There's a understanding that this loud sound of the conch shell is the reverberation of the Buddha's Dharma, his teaching of the truth. We also have a damaru, which is, traditionally this damaru is made with two skull tops put together, and then there are strings with little balls at the end, and the practitioner turns the damaru and makes a very lovely rattling sound. And then there are horns of various kinds and cymbals.
In private shrines, how intentional is the collection of the different objects?
There are varying degrees of precision involved. For some people, I think that it's extremely intentional, and they will have only certain kinds of images depending on the practice that they're doing at that time. But for many, it's just a matter of what happens to be there and what comes into their possession. Perhaps one has been gifted an item for the shrine by a friend or a family member. And so families would build up their shrines over generations, and images and icons would be there. But generally, at least one part of the shrine should relate to the practitioner's personal practice. One of the ways that Tibetan Buddhism works is that people choose one or more Buddha manifestation on which to focus. And in their practice, they will not only pray to that deity, but will also attempt, in a sense, to become that deity. So there are practices for dissolving oneself into the emptiness, that is the lack of fixed identity, and then re-arising from within emptiness in the form of the Buddha. And even if one isn't, in fact, enlightened oneself at that particular moment in time, there's a kind of sense that one is really practicing. What would it feel like to be a being whose entire motivation was entirely focused on the aims of others? That's the altruistic attitude of the Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva is the person who is destined to become a Buddha. They're on that path, and there's no turning back.